your host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to the Alchemy Podcast, where we're on a quest to explore the intersection of cannabis, compliance, and creative in the marketing world today and beyond. Welcome back to another episode of Alchemy. Today I'm joined with Bradley Tusk, founder and CEO of Tusk Holdings, which oversees the first of its kind venture capital fund investing in highly regulated markets, and Tusk Venture Partners, and Tusk Strategies, a regulatory consulting firm. Bradley, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Really excited to talk to you. You know, Bradley, your background is pretty impressive, and you've done so many things, and you're working on so many things, but you know, I think just kind of thinking about it, I'm like, wow, we could probably be on the show for hours just unpacking all the different things you've done. But I think at least to start off, you know, you have this incredible background, incredible experience on the political side, you know, everything from protecting startups like Uber from political risk to, you know, serving as Bloomberg's campaign manager. Why don't you maybe give us a little background on, you know, your work in the political space first before we move on to everything else?
Sure. So a couple of jobs directly in politics that I think were kind of interesting. So as you mentioned, ran Mike Bloomberg's mayoral campaign in 2009. Interesting campaign in that we had to extend the law on term limits to allow him to run for a third term. It was necessary to be able to keep running, but also really unpopular. So it was one of those elections that we knew was going to be really close. The entire trick to the election was making sure that no one else figured out that it would be close, because if all of the establishment kind of realized that and got behind the Democratic candidate, there was a shot we could have lost. So it was a kind of a whole kind of game of hide the ball or whatever you want to call it. But the most interesting part of that campaign was there was a guy who was talking about running that we were genuinely afraid of. He was a really talented politician. He was energetic and had a lot of ideas and good on TV. And we ran a vicious campaign to keep him out of the race. And as a result, I think saved New York City from a pretty embarrassing scandal, because you know who that guy was?
Who?
Anthony Weiner.
Oh, yes.
So instead of all the sexting and tweeting happening as a venture in Congress, it doesn't matter. It would have happened at Gracie Mansion in the City Hall. So didn't know that's what we were preventing at the time, but I'm glad we did. I also spent 4 years in Illinois as a state's deputy governor. So I ran the state's budget operations, legislation, policy, and communications. Pretty crazy job for a few reasons. The first is I was 29 when I started doing it, so I was way too young for a job like that. I wasn't even from Illinois. I worked for a guy named Rod Blagojevich, who you may remember, and he was a total sociopath. So it was both interesting working for him because he was kind of politically brilliant, but he really was also just totally fucking nuts. Is it okay if I curse?
Absolutely. We're R-rated.
God, there we go. and so, you know, I was both running the state and sort of dodging bad shit all at the same time for 4 years. And politics in Chicago and Illinois are rough. So it was a really tough 4 years. But you know, the good news is we did a lot. We were the first state to do universal health care for kids, first state to do universal preschool. We reduced the size of the state workforce by 20%. So, you know, we got to do a lot of stuff, but it was insane. I also spent a couple of years in Washington as Chuck Schumer's communications director. Chuck, as you may know, is considered the most media-hungry politician in Washington. There's this old joke in Washington, what's the most dangerous place to be between Chuck Schumer and a TV camera? Now, when Trump was in office, I had to amend that to say, you know, one of the most media-hungry. But now that Trump's gone, I think Chuck returns to the pole position again. So running his comms for 2 years was certainly not boring. And then got into politics kind of on the tech side after the Bloomberg campaign in 2009. Started my first business called Tusk Strategies, which is a political consulting firm. And we run, you know, big campaigns for companies. So you're Walmart and you want to break into four major downtowns and you've got zoning issues and labor issues and community issues. We figure all of that out. But I get a call one day in early 2011 from a friend saying, hey, there's a guy with a small transportation startup. He's having some regulatory problems. Would you mind giving him some advice? I became Uber's first political advisor that day. I get really lucky when Travis calls me back and says, hey, I can't afford your fee. Would you take equity? I didn't know what equity meant, but thank God I said yes. That was during the Series A. And then we ran all these campaigns around the U.S. where we activated our customers and defeated taxi and legalized ride sharing everywhere. And that's kind of what got me started in tech and venture. And then the final thing on politics is we are right now running Drew Yang's campaign for mayor of New York City. Hadn't actually run a direct campaign in a while, but felt like there was so much at stake right now for New York. In fact, Andrew was such a better option than the other candidates that we agreed to do it. And so far, so good. The latest poll had us at 32 and our next closest opponent at 18. But we've still got 3.5 months to go.
Amazing. So, you know, you just kind of, you know, touched a little bit on the consulting side from a, you know, political standpoint. So, you know, you guys are obviously helping startups really, you know, navigate regulatory hurdles, especially when it comes to reshaping industries. And so, you know, I'm kind of deep in that right now, at least from a cannabis perspective, you know, from a regulatory compliance standpoint. But from your experience, you know, how would you describe, you know, the impact that technology is having on really streamlining a lot of these regulatory constraints?
Yeah, I mean, so it's an interesting question because by definition, and I'm sure you see this in your work, regulation always lags innovation because first someone has to come up with a new idea, turn it into a technology, turn it into a company, start selling whatever the product or service is, start taking away market share from the incumbent. And then all of a sudden, regulators start to notice and say, oh, yeah, we got to deal with this thing, right? So you're always in some ways playing catch up, and you're always kind of fighting off bad attempts to regulate startups who are doing really good things. But it kind of falls into, you know, one of a few different categories. There's either the kind of Uber or Airbnb FanDuel scenario where you're not creating something entirely new. You're coming up with a better way to do it. And, you know, eventually the incumbent realizes they're starting to lose market share. They lean on the politicians that they give money to put you out of business. And then you have a big fight and you try to preserve what you do. Or it could be you're just an entirely new white space, and, you know, to begin with. So it's crypto, it's AI, it's machine learning, it's drones, it's esports, it's things that it's not just that it's a different way of doing it. It's just no one's ever done it before in the first place. So there's no regulation around it.
Right.
And then you've got to create a regulatory framework, or things fall kind of somewhere in between the two. And so, but no matter how you look at it, every new company, in my view, is in some way a tech company, right? You can't sell a product or a service and not use technology to either make it, produce it, transport it, advertise it, sell it, whatever it is, right? So definitionally, you know, there's no such thing as a company doing something new that isn't a tech company. And you've got a lot of companies that have come up with better ways to do things, whether it's in entirely new areas or just taking existing things and making them different and better. And that produces for regulators a lot of friction, a lot of confusion, a lot of conflict. And, you know, that's sort of where the opportunity lies for our venture fund.
Awesome. So, you know, I think from a investing perspective, like you're investing in a lot of startups, especially, you know, in regulated industries. I'm just curious for you, you know, personally, like what makes you so invested in empowering highly regulated industries, right? Because it's, I think a lot of people might look at it and say, yeah, that's a lot of work and I'd rather go a different.
I'll tell you why, because some startups are good, some are not good. Some have amazing ideas, some don't. Some execute them really well, some don't, right? So it's not some inherent view that all technology is good or all tech companies are good. But you know what's not good? When people use political power to stop startups from being able to exist, from being able to innovate. That's just corruption, right? Yeah. And like if you think about what we had with Uber, just as an example, the taxi industry had done a really shitty job for a really long time. And the only thing they had going for it was they hired a lot of lobbyists and they gave a lot of political contributions. And they tried to use that to put us out of business. And if it weren't for the fact that we had an incredibly tough founder in Travis Kalanick and a really dedicated customer base that was willing to go to bat for us, you guys, if no one listens, would ever heard of Uber because we wouldn't exist. And that would have really, you know, been a disservice to cities all over the world, to people all over the world. So, look, a technology should succeed or fail on its merits, but it's able to do that based on how good or bad its product is, not because some entrenched old line interest, you know, gives money to a state senator. And as a result, you know, they don't want any competition. So to me, I like to think of us as that thing standing in the way of new innovation and the corruption that stops it from getting out into the marketplace. And that's what kind of gets us going.
Awesome. So, yeah, I mean, I was taking a look at, you know, some of the companies in your portfolio, and obviously you're doing some very interesting stuff across so many different verticals. You've got, Bird on the micro-mobility, you know, front. You've got Rove for digital health, Lemonade for insurance, sustainability with Sunday. And I was really excited to talk to you just because, as I mentioned before, you know, I'm kind of running a number of business units at Philo. We've got a compliance regulation platform for cannabis. We've got, you know, loyalty and CRM. We've got data. Like, we've got all these incredible things that are extremely, extremely regulated. And people are kind of like, why didn't I think of this? Like, when they hear about our technology. And so I was really looking forward to having you on the show because I wanted to talk to you as far as, you know, the cannabis industry. You talk quite a bit about it.
Yeah.
And I think it'd be great for everyone who's listening in now. Like, I'd love to hear from you. Like, what are you most excited about when it comes to the cannabis opportunity in front of us right now?
Yeah. So a few things. So first of all, you know, we're at this inflection point where I think everyone, not everyone, most people under the age of 40 would agree that cannabis should be recreationally legal, right? And as a result, it's a big normative shift in society, just like, say, same-sex marriage or women's rights or so many other key issues, civil rights. And so seeing society shift its views and then act on it, even in and of itself, to me, is pretty fascinating. So that's number one. Number two, we're at a particularly interesting moment because COVID meant that state and city budgets were just absolutely decimated across the board. And when that happens, they need to find new sources of revenue. So I think there's going to be a banner year for legalization of cannabis here in New York, simply because if you believe that politicians make all decisions based on what's politically most feasible for them at that moment, so every policy output is the result of a political input, then in a normal year when the budget is really flush, say, okay, you know, I could legalize cannabis. These people want it. These people don't want it. And you kind of have to weigh the political pros and cons. But now, if you don't do something like legalizing cannabis, your alternative is really raising taxes or cutting money for schools or for healthcare or for infrastructure. And politically, those are far worse choices, right? So all of a sudden, the politically easiest choice is recreational cannabis legalization. And so as a result, I think this is a year where a lot of states are going to go ahead and move forward on it. So number one, that's exciting. And then on top of that, you know, my hope is that this is the beginning of a longer trend. So we're starting to see piecemeal, but some jurisdictions decriminalize psilocybin, which is, you know, mushrooms and other.
Oh, yeah. Gen. I'm very, 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 very keen on psilocybin. I've invested in a number of companies and I like it too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the next frontier.
Who doesn't? Ketamine, I think you're going to see changes coming in around that because I think there are legitimate uses for PTSD treatment and other types of trauma. And so to me, we're on kind of a slow but steady stream right now of legalizing different types of drugs that I personally hope, and I know this is a controversial statement, at least in 2021, that it results in the legalization of all drugs. And it's not that I want people to do heroin or cocaine or fentanyl or anything like that. And it's not that every single drug needs to be available at the local store. But I think that we live in a world where people who want to consume drugs clearly have access to them one way or the other. But by being illegal, it creates all of these negative externalities, all of this violence of the cartels in Mexico and Latin America and South America, all of this violence in cities in the U.S., you know, millions of people, mainly men, in jail for, you know, crimes that if this were alcohol, it would be completely legal. Hundreds of billions of dollars in costs in law enforcement, criminal justice, prisons, all of that. And just so many lives ruined when in reality, drugs are another form of alcohol, right? And in the alcohol industry, you don't have cartel violence. You don't have massive criminal justice problems because it is a taxed and regulated business. And people, big companies now own and produce the brands, and people who are over 21 can go to the store and buy what they need. And there's still alcoholism. But at the end of the day, a lot of the other problems that exist around drugs don't exist around alcohol. And I think we've got to get to that point on drugs. And so ultimately, when we get to a world where cannabis is legal and ketamine is legal and psilocybin is legal, then maybe it's cocaine or maybe it's heroin. You know, these are not things that I personally, you know, use or indulge in. But enough people do that the market is clearly there. And the war on drugs has been a failure now for decades and decades. And we've got to try something different.
I mean, I think it's pretty interesting just from a market standpoint right now. Like I see there's so many industries, especially I'd say the, you know, spirits and, you know, beer industry in particular. Like there's a lot of people that are just kind of shifting their usage right now where they might be, let's just say, taking an edible on a weekend or smoking a joint at night for sleep or whatever it is. And you're starting to see like this massive shift, especially from all of these, you know, big CPG alcohol and spirits company where they're like, hey, we need to kind of move our business into that realm too. And you've already seen it with, you've got Pabst where they're launching, or they've launched, you know, Pabst Labs with the THC seltzer. You know, Lagunitas that has their hi-fi beverage that has THC. So like things are really rapidly growing. And I think just this year alone, there's just, it's almost like it was a switch, like the massive acceptance everywhere. And I'm still kind of scratching my head on, you have Colorado, California, Michigan, Illinois, all these states where it's now recreational on the, you know, legal weed side. And New York, we're still not legal.
Like, yeah. Yeah,
New York, like it blows my mind. Like how it's possible that it's still illegal in New York? It makes no sense.
I'll take a shot at the answer if you want. Which is, so number one, our governor, who may not be governor a week from now, by the time this, whenever this podcast airs, it's a guy whose thinking is very stuck in a different era. Right, we're seeing that now with his treatment of women that's coming out. But, you know, this is a guy that called marijuana a gateway drug like 2 years ago, right? His head is still like it's 1994 or something like that. And he just hasn't evolved intellectually in any way. And so even though he has said publicly he supports it, he's only said that because he's looked at the polls. You know, he's looked at where Democratic primary voters are and know he has to say it, but he doesn't actually believe it. And so he did everything he could behind the scenes to really prevent success of legalization efforts in 2020, 2019. So you had a combination of a bad governor combined with COVID just made every other issue almost impossible last year. So you kind of lost a year of progress on pretty much everything. And then also, you know, the states around us are only first doing it too. So it seems to be politically that states beget other regional states. So Michigan gets you Illinois, Oregon gets you California, Massachusetts does have it, but that's more of a New England-y state. But you know, now the New Jersey has it. I think that helps New York, but the kind of tri-state area to date hasn't had it yet. So the political pressure that gets created by people saying, you know what, all right, fuck it, I'll just go to Connecticut or Jersey and get my weed. Like I don't care. And all of a sudden, they're getting all of the revenue and benefit from it. Jersey, which has now passed, that still hasn't opened anything up yet in terms of dispensaries. So the political pressure that I think has worked in other jurisdictions hasn't really existed in New York yet. But the good news is, in a way, New York is facing an unbelievable budget deficit. Even with the money coming in from Washington and the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, there's still somewhere between a $6 to $10 billion shortfall. And one of the things that would make that up is the revenue that you would generate from recreational cannabis. And so the good news is it really should happen here. The bad news is, and we're recording this on March, what's today, 12th, you know, the budget is supposed to be done March 31st, so 19 days from now, and all these 1,000% dysfunctional. We have a governor that now a majority of members of the legislature have called on to resign. Impeachment proceedings have begun. He, at the same time, had a press conference today saying, I will not resign. And so as we go through that battle, what happens to the budget? What happens to cannabis?
Exactly. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so moving on from cannabis. So I think you know, one thing I wanted to talk to you about on having you on here too is you're quite active in the SPAC world.
Yeah.
And SPACs are kind of like the new craze, and they're getting pretty big. So what's your thought?
Yeah. So here's why I raised a SPAC and kind of what I've learned about it since. So I've owned a casino management company for a long time. And, you know, probably 3 or 4 years ago, I had this eureka moment of, you know, every casino is kind of the same. If you're in the shittiest riverboat casino or the fanciest casino in Vegas, they're all a variation on the same theme. It's effectively gold playing and red carpets and Wheel of Fortune slot machines. And it's one type of entertainment for one type of demographic, and that's it. And if you look at it, there's 140 million millennials and Gen Zs in this country. And it's not that they don't necessarily want to gamble, but they've got different tastes, different interests, different perspective. So my thought was, what if you had a casino that really focused on esports betting, which is video game betting, or regular sports betting, or fantasy, or the activities were axe throwing, or pop-up soul cycles? Like, couldn't that appeal to a different generation? So I wanted to buy a casino and try to do this. And my cost of capital was always really high, and so I could never win the auction. And so I wasn't able to do it, and I'd kind of given up on it. And then two things happened in 2020. One, COVID, and then two, the SPAC craze. So the cost of assets in the physical gaming industry went way down, and the ability to raise money in an efficient manner went way up through SPACs. And so my partner, Christian Good, and I, you know, called some bankers that we knew and said, do you think this would be feasible for us? They said, yeah, we really do. And from literally 3 months from when we had the first conversation until the money was sitting in the bank in escrow, we raised $300 million. We are a public company on the NASDAQ, the Ivory Gaming Acquisition Corporation. Since then, we've been in a process to acquire a gaming company. And I can't comment because we're a public company on the status of it. But the thing I have learned from it, and I think that works in our favor, is, you know, there's a lot of SPACs out there right now. It's kind of the trendy thing to do, like you said. And it makes sense when the company that does the SPAC and is trying to do a business transaction with an existing company adds real strategic value. So in our case, the hard part of gaming is not how do you take a bet. It's how do you get a license. It's regulatory. And that is, anyone who's listening to us for the last 22 minutes knows, is the thing I'm supposed to be good at, my team is supposed to be good at. And so we've been able to at least have conversations with gaming companies who have really good technology, really good ideas, but they lack that political sophistication. So therefore, the combination of that and our capital becomes attractive. So I think whenever you have an acquiring company that is really genuinely strategic, it will probably do well as a SPAC. When you just raise a SPAC because it's because of FOMO and it's a cool thing to do, then I think some of those are going to run into trouble, and some SPACs that are raised are not going to ultimately convert, and some people will lose some money.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Well, this has been great having you on, and, you know, hearing all of your advice, especially from politics to regulation and now SPACs. And so, Bradley, if you listen to the show before, we always end on some quick fire questions.
Yeah, great. So
I know you a little better. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. So first question, what was the best or worst practical joke that you've played on someone or that was played on you?
Let's see. I remember when I was 16, I did this like summer at school program, and there was a girl that I was dating. We broke up. She kind of put shaving cream all over my bed, and then rather than do anything destructive, I just waited till she was out, went to her room, and very calmly packed everything she had in her suitcases, neatly stored them under her bed. And when she came in, the room was completely blank. But of course, everything was folded and packed very nicely right underneath. And she liked it so much that we ended up dating again.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Good story. What's your favorite food?
Oh, that's such a hard question. So I think it comes in different categories, right? So tonight, my wife is out, my daughter is out, so it's me and my son. We will have a steak, right? But my daughter, who's a vegetarian, I have now become like a genuine lover of tofu. So if I'm eating that with her, or it depends where I'm traveling. So, and look, the part of the reason that anyone puts up with living in New York City and pays these crazy prices for housing and rent and everything else is there's not just one kind of food you can enjoy. There's hundreds. And that's probably the best thing about New York.
Love it. Okay. So here's a quick thing I want you to do. Look at your phone.
Yep.
And I'm curious, what was the last photo you took? Hopefully it's not R-rated.
It's not R-rated because I'm not that cool. so the question is, what was it? And I think I'm looking it up right now. And I think hopefully it's just something that's interesting. Let's see. It was my insurance card, the front and the back, because I got a COVID shot today.
And oh, good for you.
Doing these stuff online, it required you to upload your insurance card. So that's what I did. And I will say the experience of getting it was actually really, really easy and good. Went to Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, had a 7:45 appointment, got there at 7:30. I was back at our apartment in Gramercy by 8:30.
Nice. Very good. I'm probably going to be the last one to get it.
So interesting in that I assume that about me too, but there are some weird exceptions. So I volunteer weekly at the soup kitchen and I was there yesterday and they said, did you get your shot? And I said, no, it's going to be a while until I'm eligible. And they said, no, you're eligible right now. I said, what do you mean? I said, if you work at a soup kitchen, you're eligible. Went online. They were right. And made an appointment for the next day. And here we are. So, usually they say no good deed goes unrewarded, but in this case it worked out.
No, that's great. And you're doing that's so nice that you're doing that too. Okay, so last question. I ask different questions every show, but this one I think is kind of fun. So what are you most looking forward to after the pandemic is over?
Oh God, that's such a good question. We were supposed to go to the Olympics in Tokyo last year. Obviously, it didn't happen. I still have this slight hope that we'll be able to go this August. I think it's unlikely, but that would be really great. But you know what? Maybe it's some of the basic stuff. I haven't been inside of a restaurant in a year. And again, living in New York, that's one of the fun things to do. I've been working out digitally with my trainer, but haven't been inside the gym. In a year. I haven't been to a movie in a year. So I think more than it being something really big, like going to the Olympics in Tokyo, I think it's a lot of stuff that day to day that we enjoy and take for granted, and then all of a sudden disappeared from our life. And I think when we get it back, it's going to feel pretty special.
Yeah, I can't wait. Awesome. Well, Bradley, it was great having you on the show. Bradley Tusk, CEO of Tusk Holdings. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.